Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the history and meaning of impeachment. This week brought the first public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump's dealings with Ukraine.
To withhold that assistance for no good reason other than help with the political campaign made no sense.
The hearings have been long, with partisan bickering on full display. They are also historic. It's a rare thing for Congress to use this tool, crafted by the framers, to hold the president's power in check. My guest, Harvard Law professor Cass Sunstein, says that's a good thing. He's the author of Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. I spoke with him Friday morning about what our founding documents say should and should not be considered an impeachable offense. Professor Sunstein, thank you for joining us. Let's start with what a president can be impeached for. Why did the framers of the Constitution decide to leave this as wide open as they did?
I think immersion in the history suggests that they actually didn't leave it wide open, focusing on the details from the 18th century, more time than I think a sensible person would.
I'm glad somebody does.
To my surprise, they used the word high crimes and misdemeanors precisely in order not to leave it wide open, to leave it very specific and concrete. That term was meant to ensure that the House of Representatives couldn't impeach a president for being a bad guy, for making terrible policy choices, for disagreeing strongly with the American people. The whole point of high crimes and misdemeanors is to narrow the grounds, but also to give a concrete sense, really concrete sense, of what the grounds are. So high crimes and misdemeanors back then was a lot like the term motor vehicles today. Where we know what that word means. In the 18th century, if we said motor vehicles, they wouldn't have had any clue. And we are reading high crimes and misdemeanors often in the same clueless way they would read motor vehicles. They meant gross abuse of authority. And they had a pretty clear sense, actually a very clear sense of what that meant. It wouldn't include disorderly conduct. It wouldn't include not paying your taxes. It wouldn't include shoplifting. But it would include violating civil liberties. That was called out specifically as a ground for impeachment in the ratification debates. It would include abusing the pardon power. That was concretely referred to by James Madison in the Virginia ratifying debates. It would include lying to Congress in order to get a treaty ratified. That was specifically referred to in North Carolina. So what they meant was something that involved use of presidential authority in a way that was terribly abusive. And, you know, we could debate some borderline cases, but as they understood the term, really the cases that fell within the category were clear and cases that fell outside of the category were clear.
So when has it been used for the right reasons?
In the Nixon case, actually, the most compelling article was using the apparatus of government to go after political enemies. That was one of the articles. It had nothing to do with Watergate itself, but it was the strongest. That one was really connected with what made the impeachment clause so precious to the framers and ratifiers. That is to ensure that we didn't have anything like a replication of what led to the War for Independence, no kings. And abuses of civil liberties would be kind of defining. Also in the Nixon case, the use of the apparatus of government to spy on political opponents, not as bad as using the apparatus of government to go after political enemies, but to spy on political opponents. That's an impeachable offense. That's the kind of thing they were talking about.
So when the impeachment articles were brought against Andrew Jackson and Bill Clinton, were those for the right reasons or the wrong reasons?
The wrong reasons. Both of those were partisan matters, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of reasonable people were very unhappy with President Clinton, and while they're not around anymore, President Andrew Johnson, a lot of reasonable people are unhappy with him. It wasn't an impeachable offense. So in the Johnson case, the primary ground was that he, in violation of law, fired a member of his cabinet. And that was a violation of law back then because there was a law called the Tenure in Office Act, which said you couldn't fire him just because you wanted to. It even specifically said that law, if you did, it would be a high crime and misdemeanor. But Congress can't make something into a high crime and misdemeanor just by announcing it. The Constitution specifies what counts. That is, the context of the Constitution gives us a sense. And President Johnson fired a cabinet member thinking he had the constitutional authority to do that. And he actually turned out to be right on that. Supreme Court later ruled, but even if he was wrong, it was a reasonable view. And a reasonable mistake of law isn't an impeachable offense. The Clinton one is much more salient to us today. And the president, that is President Clinton, probably both perjured himself and obstructed justice in connection with the Paula Jones sexual harassment suit. That is, he probably perjured himself about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and he probably obstructed justice with respect to the investigation of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And when I say probably, I'm being very cautious. He almost certainly perjured himself and committed obstruction of justice. But those aren't impeachable offenses within the meaning of the Constitution, because the president, while he didn't do something, if he committed a crime that is excusable, violations of the criminal law are, you know, a grave matter. He didn't abuse the apparatus of the presidency in the sense that the Constitution makes relevant. So if you want to think about what's an impeachable offense, read the Declaration of Independence. That reads like articles of impeachment, and that's not an accident. It was written against a background in which impeachment had become very salient to the American colonists.
Now, the other day, we heard House Speaker Nancy Pelosi use the word bribery against President Trump. We heard that for the first time. Is that a deliberate use of that word in relation to impeachment?
Yes, I think she was being very lawyerly in a good way. She's either herself, you know, pondering the constitutional requirements or working with advisors who are well-schooled. So high crimes and misdemeanors is the kind of catch-all phrase for things like abusing people's civil rights or abusing the pardon power. But treason and bribery are specifically called out. So you don't have to do any, you know, interpretation, really, if you're within the category. And if there was bribery, then there is clearly an impeachable offense. And I think that's what she is signaling, either that she believes it or that she thinks it's something that's very possibly what happened.
Do you believe that House Democrats who are moving forward with impeachment against President Trump over Ukraine are within the boundaries of the Constitution and what it calls for in the way of impeachment?
Well, I think they've been, in general, acting with a sense of the gravity and infrequency of the impeachment mechanism. So I'm hoping that the average Democrat right now in the House of Representatives is listening carefully rather than moving decisively. And you can have something that's kind of in between the two. To say that the use of presidential authority with respect to taxpayer money to get a foreign country to investigate a political opponent is the domain of an impeachable offense is clearly correct. So to say we're going to launch an impeachment inquiry to understand exactly what happened here is exactly right, and not to do it would be exactly wrong. To say as of today I'm voting for impeachment would be getting, I think, a little ahead of the skis, that the president know, whether you think he's the best president or the worst president, deserves something a little short of reverence, not by virtue of his person, but by virtue of his office, which means that to take up the impeachment mantle in the sense of voting for it requires real clarity on exactly what happened and why.
As you and I are speaking, Ambassador Yovanovitch is testifying before members of Congress. I wonder whether anything you've heard this week in public testimony helped clarify for you whether he should be impeached.
I think it's been profoundly clarifying, actually much more clarifying than I think anyone would have expected. So we have agreement, it appears, on two propositions. The first is if a president withholds funds in order to respond to corruption and to ask for an investigation of corruption, I think we have unanimity that that's fine, and that's a good thing to have unanimity on. I think we have near unanimity on the following. This is slightly more subtle, but the Republicans' arguments seem to suggest they agree with this, that if a president uses funds to obtain a criminal investigation that has no foundation of a political opponent, and if he succeeds in obtaining that investigation, then impeachment must follow. The Republican arguments wouldn't make sense unless they're actually agreeing with that proposition, which really narrows what we're talking about. One question is whether seeking but not succeeding in getting a criminal investigation of a political opponent is impeachable. And apparently people are disagreeing about that, and that's a pretty specific question. And the second one is whether the president reasonably believed that someone whose last name is Biden engaged in corruption. And that's also discussable, whether he actually believed it or whether he didn't really care. He just wanted his political opponent to be embarrassed or, put in disrepute. So these may seem more subtle than the headlines, but they're suggesting that we are getting clarity on what reasonable people can disagree on. And I guess I'd say that from the standpoint of the White House, the testimony thus far and the responses to the testimony by the president's defenders are making things look more difficult, much more difficult than they had looked a week ago.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Cass Sunstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Cass Sunstein. His book is titled Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. He's a law professor at Harvard University. It's so interesting that even as Ambassador Yovanovitch was testifying, apparently the president was tweeting about her testimony, yet he has refused to cooperate with a lawful investigation. Is that an impeachable offense?
In the Nixon impeachment, one of the articles that obtained a majority in the House Judiciary Committee was a failure to respond to a lawful subpoena. And there's a strong argument that that was fair. So for the president not to respond affirmatively to a subpoena is a ballpark of an impeachable offense. What the president would have to say is something like, I have a privilege against responding to the subpoena, executive privilege or something, and that's a hard argument to make. Or, and this is an even harder argument to make, I think the whole thing's a sham, And so my non-cooperation is a response to an illegitimate stunt. I don't think it's true, but maybe the president thinks it's true, probably does think it's true. Still, it shows a disrespect for a coordinate branch of government, which would be a very serious matter in the context of what the Constitution authorizes, that is an impeachment inquiry. So this is a unduly long way of saying that drawing up an article of impeachment for refusing to respond to lawful subpoenas would be a not unreasonable thing to do, and there's precedent for it. And it wouldn't be reckless to vote in favor of that if the president continues not to respond. It wouldn't be the strongest one, but it wouldn't be a baseless one.
What about his refusal to release information about his taxes?
Okay, so that is not an impeachable offense by itself. So if a president or anyone who is subject to the impeachment mechanism says, I'm not telling about my taxes, that's not an abuse of presidential authority. So he is tied up in New York in a process that he's not liking, but he's making the best arguments he has against disclosing his taxes, and the Supreme Court might well take the case. That's a different kettle of fish. That's something where the American people can say, we don't like this very much, that is, we want to see his taxes, or they can say, as tens of millions did in 2016, we don't really care so much about that. That's not an impeachable issue.
So you take me to my very next thought, which is some people have said President Trump is who he is. Let us simply allow the American people at the next election decide whether he should continue or not and dispense with all of these hearings.
That's one of the arguments that's least wonderful on the president's behalf. And the reason it doesn't count as wonderful is that it's a betrayal of our Constitution. This issue was specifically debated in Philadelphia, whether the four-year term was a sufficient safeguard and whether it was enough to say, let the voters decide. And that was roundly repudiated both in Philadelphia by Hamilton and Madison and Franklin and, you know, our iconic figures. And even more importantly than it was being repudiated by them, basically all of them, it was repudiated by we the people when we ratified the Constitution with specific reference to the impeachment mechanism. So saying let the voters decide, as some people who, you know, for whom I have a great deal of respect, have said in the president's behalf, that's not right. And it wouldn't be right if it was a Democratic president either. The voters get the right to decide, sure, but there's also this mechanism. And whichever way it goes, it can't have an X through it by virtue of the fact that we're going to have an election.
What do you make of the Republicans' argument that the quid pro quo did not work because Ukraine got its aid and that should be the end of it? There was no quid pro quo.
I think that's, in one form, that's a fair argument. And every member of the House and Senate should think hard about it. So here's one reason it's fair. An attempted crime is punished less severely than a completed crime. And to say that, you know, the president tried but failed, and that doesn't have the degree of gravity that we would observe if there was actually an investigation by a foreign country of the Bidens, that's fair. The problem with it is that a solicitation can be bribery, even if the person who solicited says, you've got to be kidding, right? So the constitutional term bribery includes solicitations, and that is a problem for the argument. And a second problem is while an attempted crime is less grave than a completed crime, an attempted crime is still a crime. And so an attempted murder or attempt, if you try treason and fail, be hard to argue that that wouldn't be an impeachable offense. It's also the case that even though there wasn't an investigation and the money went through, there was a significant delay before the money came. And anyone who is, you know, involved in difficult international matters, including with Russia, as Ukraine was, a delay in order to provoke an investigation is real, a matter of months, apparently. And that's not as if nothing happened. So this is an argument worth considering, and it's very fair to raise that unlike the people are going to vote rationale, but it does run into these problems.
I'm also interested in the role of outside players in this whole Ukraine business and whether designating, if I may use that word loosely, Rudy Giuliani and others to be working behind the scenes almost against what Ambassador Yovanovitch was doing. It confuses, I think, many Americans as to say, well, so what? The president wanted Rudy Giuliani to do this, so why not let him do it? So what's wrong with that?
It's a great question. So I was privileged to work in the White House for 4 years under President Obama. And while my own job involved regulation, civil rights, the environment, worker safety, and such, I saw very close up, you know, people whose offices were really near mine working on these kinds of questions. And for a president to have someone who isn't either confirmed by the Senate or employed by the U.S. government through the safeguards and checks that the employment process offers, for any president to have someone freelancing who's basically not a government employee on matters of state, that's very unusual and concerning. There are security protocols that people who engage in foreign policy negotiations go through. There are safeguards of multiple kinds, if only that they get a special phone, which means that they have a secure line to engage in conversations that need to be secure. They have security clearance to get read into stuff. So I'm not sure exactly how to think of the magnitude of this breach of normal practice, but there's no question that it's not well advised and it's fraught with risks. Among other things, it could confound Mr. Giuliani's legitimate role in being the president's lawyer, and any president is entitled to that, with the more, let's say, controversial or illegitimate role of being the president's policymaker who isn't employed by the U.S. government.
Could indeed Rudolph Giuliani be in some way held liable for any and all actions he may or may not have carried out in Ukraine, contradicting those of legitimate State Department officials?
I think if he were in my office right now and asking, does he have to worry about criminal liability, I'd give a two-part answer. I'd say first, in general, no, that your role, even if highly unusual, as a policy advisor and participant outside of the employ of the federal government, that is not itself a crime. But I'd want to look very carefully at the restrictions on what private citizens can do in negotiating, even on behalf of the U.S. government, at the behest of the president, to see if there are particular things that Giuliani may have done which transgress the criminal law. And I'd say, if you're going to hire me, it's not going to be a one-hour consultation. It's going to take a lot of work, which is a way of saying that he's potentially in legal jeopardy for some specific things, though the general role is probably okay as a matter of federal criminal law.
Interesting. I think you see as clearly as I that most, if not all, Republican lawmakers are standing firm with the president. And I find myself wondering, on what grounds can they continue to do this? Is it because loyalty to the president becomes more important than loyalty to the country, or is it just totally raw politics?
The little story that when I was up for confirmation, the Republicans were basically opposing me. And behind closed doors, one of them said, "You're going to be great. I'm completely for you. I think you're really going to do a tremendous job, and I'm so happy the president chose you." And then he paused and he said, "Of course I'm voting against you."
Ugh.
He said with a big smile. And it was so warm and so real that I actually smiled right back. And that's a much lower stakes issue, whether one person gets confirmed. But it shows that sometimes people will say privately something very different from what they will say publicly. And that's both a problem, but in things that have a degree of, you know, gravity, it's an opportunity. So if there's increasing clarity, let's say, that the president really did commit an impeachable offense, I wouldn't be at all surprised if the solid Republican support for him starts to soften. That is what happened under President Nixon. And as a famous baseball player, Yogi Berra, once said, predictions are very difficult, especially about the future.
What would it take, do you think, for that Republican support to soften? What kind of statement, what kind of evidence, what could be a turning point?
Well, if it is entirely clear that the president offered financial assistance, if and only if there would be a criminal investigation of the Bidens, if that was very, very clear, and if the American people see that clearly, then cracks in the Republican wall would start to emerge. The cracks might first come from independent voters and Republican voters. They might first come from people like Senator Romney. But cracks can become a breakage. And we do have two issues outstanding that I think Republicans not unreasonably want clarity on. One is, how relevant is it that the money actually came to Ukraine? And the second is, what was the president's state of mind exactly? Was he reasonably thinking that there was corruption on the part of the Bidens? And while those are arguably desperate efforts to protect their leader, they're not crazy questions to ask. And if they get clean answers, then we could see something like a flood.
I am concerned for the safety of the whistleblower. And Republicans have called for that person's identity and presence over and over and over again. How serious would it be if the identity of the whistleblower were released?
Also a great question, and it's getting perhaps less attention than it deserves. So some people who've worked for both Republican and Democratic administrations have been subject to credible death threats under more innocent circumstances. And you're speaking to one. I was subject, after some horrible attacks, I was subject to a credible death threat at my unlisted home address. And the authorities had to get involved. For the whistleblower, there are two really bad things. One is the safety of the whistleblower personally will be at risk. There's not a question at all about that. That doesn't mean there'll be a gun fired, but it does mean that there'll be threats. And the second is the deterrent effect on future whistleblowers of the release of the name cannot be underestimated. And under both, I do feel it's very important to say that Democratic administrations have done not good things at all, some of them, and President Johnson, so many people would say the same thing about the Clinton administration, and no party is perfect. So the idea that disclosing the name of a whistleblower would be something Republicans would want and Democrats wouldn't want, that's wild. Protection of whistleblowers should be a nonpartisan issue, both to protect the integrity of the system and to protect individual human beings whose lives can be, if not eliminated, they can be destroyed just because they're doing something which by their own lights, let's say at in a way that's most cautious, by their own lights, they're doing something that's a patriotic act.
Do you believe that the name or identity of the whistleblower will be uncovered and released?
I don't have a crystal ball on that. So we've seen so many big surprises over the course of the last, you know, let's say 6 years, let alone 6 months, that I wouldn't make a prediction about that. It's profoundly to be hoped that it won't. Usually it's the case that if there's something secret that important people want to be public, it gets public. So that's the course of history. But let's hope profoundly, for the sake of the whistleblower, as well as, and as importantly, for the sake of whistleblowing, that that doesn't happen.
We have a lot of people who are going to be testifying next week, including Alexander Vindman, Kurt Volker, and Fiona Hill. Do you believe that anything that any of those or other witnesses have to say will somehow change the narrative that we have heard thus far?
I do. I think that given the number and given the surprising nature of even what we heard this week, the likelihood is very high that there'll be something that will alter the narrative in people's minds. It might be that the alteration will simply be clarification of one thing or another. And, you know, I think the supporters of the president should hope that what will get clarified is that he was really interested in corruption generally, and the Biden line was a throwaway. I personally would be surprised if that got clarified that in that direction, but, you know, it could happen. Or it could be that the kind of increasingly simple account, which is the president was saying, you get money if you investigate my potential 2020 opponent, that will be an inescapable inference. That would be less surprising, but that would be a clearer version of the narrative that's still a little murky.
Well, Professor Sunstein, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruntberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher, Josephine Neonai, and Natalie Urev-Lipker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.